Okay. Well, it's good to be here. It's been a while. It's been a while since we've been here in Portsmouth. And it's good to see all of our old friends here. Be nice if I could say we were all young friends, but we're getting to be older and older friends as we go along. I'm just making the illusion to having Alzheimer's disease and instead of Alzheimer's. Not all the way there yet, but hopefully won't get there. That's a terrible disease. It really is. Over the 4th of July holiday, took a trip, went up to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and we visited the battlefields there at Gettysburg. As many of you know, I've always been an avid follower of history, and that's a bit of history that's always intrigued me. Of course, it occurred on July the 1st through the 3rd in 1863, and so they actually went through the process of celebrating the battle on July the 1st through the 3rd this year. It was the 148th anniversary of the battle. In two more years, on the 150th anniversary, they're going to have a big celebration there, much like they did on the 200th anniversary. And I understand there are going to be a lot of reenactments there at that time. But they wanted it to be sort of real time. On July the 1st, this is what happened. And there was actually a series of presentations by some of the park rangers that occurred in real time at 10 o'clock. This happened, and so the ranger was there to go through that part of the battle at 10 o'clock. Then at noon, and just as you marched down through the day, you went to various places around the battlefield to hear what was happening at that point in time, 148 years ago, that minute. Well, the Confederate Army came onto the field at Gettysburg on July the 1st, about 10 o'clock in the morning, with the first small group of what was ultimately to be about 75,000 men under Lieutenant General Robert E. Lee. And he was met by cavalry from the Union Army, General John Buford, with about two brigades of cavalry. That would have been about 2,700 to 3,000 men. And they clashed. The Confederates came to get shoes because there was a shoe factory in Gettysburg, and they were pretty much barefooted, all of them. So they heard about these shoes, and so they came to get shoes and ran in. And one of the biggest battles, probably the largest battle in American history, occurred because of shoes. The Union Army had about 90,000 men. So you're looking at about 165,000 men, all with some gun or another, trying desperately to kill the others. And as a result, at the end of 3 days, 50,000 men lay on the field. 50,000 casualties, thereabouts. In some places, for instance, a place called the Battle at the Railroad Cut. There was a railroad to the west and north of Gettysburg. One soldier wrote a letter home after the battle and said that he would have been able to walk, and I think it was a half to three-quarter mile, on the bodies of fallen soldiers and not set his foot onto the ground in the process. And in some places, they were piled up 3 deep. Well, there were stories of great heroism and great exhibitions of courage. And in some cases, stories of men going forward into battle, into the face of, to all appearances, what was going to be absolute death, and going forward anyway. And it's not just in Gettysburg, but it was the same in the First World War, the same in the Second World War, the same in any war that occurs. And you, the question that I've had to ask myself time and again as I've studied man and his dealings with his other men, mankind, is why would a man or a woman do that? What is it that motivates a human being to face certain death and to go forward? There has to be something that would cause somebody to disregard their life and to go to their death, and to do it knowingly and willingly. I'm going to answer that question today. First, I want to state that we as Christians, we who are the followers of Jesus Christ, are expected to do that very thing. And there has to be a reason why we will do it, and why we would do it. I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that we are engaged in a great war. You know, Ephesians, the 6th chapter, discusses that. In Ephesians, the 6th chapter, in verse 10, we're instructed by the Apostle Paul when he says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God." No point in putting on armor unless you're at war. It's hot. It's heavy. I mean, you only put on armor because you need armor. You are engaged in a great battle, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. You know? We are at war with Satan and his army. And time and time and time again, the Scriptures use that symbolism to show. I mean, you know, the king that goes into battle and doesn't count the cost. That's an allusion to war. We have to know where we're going, why we're going, and what it's going to cost us to go there. Verse 12, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." You know, Ellen was talking about she would like to have been able to see the heavenly hosts that Elisha saw and be encouraged by that. But I dare say if you saw all of the heavenly hosts, there might be a moment of fear as well as a moment of encouragement, because they are there and they are as real as the heavenly hosts, the angels of God, the legions And so in verse 13, Paul continues by saying, therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. You know, it was in the part of the Battle of Gettysburg known as the Battle of Little Round Top. General Meade's chief engineer was sent out to look over the battlefield to see what might be needed. Well, he came on this piece of this hill, and it looked all along the Union line. And he concluded, and it was empty. There was nobody there. And he concluded, if the Confederates come up on top of this hill and locate cannon up here, they can shoot right down the length of the Union line. And if they don't hit the first guy, they're going to hit the second guy or the third guy, and they have command of the entire Union position. So he said, we got to get some people up here. So he went out and he found anybody he could get his hands on. A fellow of the name of Colonel Strong Vincent had a division that was just coming up the road to the battlefield. And he says, come on, get up on top of this hill. And there was in that, he had three brigades. And each brigade has three regiments. So it's nine regiments altogether. A regiment being beaten up by war was like 300 or 400 men. So 3,600 men altogether on top of this hill, fast as you can get there, because here come the rebels and they're coming to the same place. So they get on this hill, and one unit called the 20th Maine, the 20th Maine Regiment, led by a man by the name of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. He was a teacher of religion in a college in Maine. Was in command of that regiment. And they, Colonel Vincent told him, Colonel Chamberlain, you're at the end of the line. The Union Army stops here. You've got these other guys on your right hand, but on your left hand, there is nobody. Nobody. You are to defend this place to the last. You're going to be outnumbered. They were outnumbered about 3-1. And he says, you cannot retreat from this site. If you do, the battle is lost for the entire army. 90,000 men lost. And so they got up onto the hill and almost immediately came under attack. In some cases, they didn't even have time to load their rifles, because they didn't carry them when they were marching loaded, I suppose. And so they came to a point where they ran out of ammunition. Had no ammunition. And so he concluded, I cannot leave. I cannot retreat. And I cannot stay here, because we will die if we stay here. The next attack. And so he had his men fix bayonets, and his solution was, we can't leave, we can't stay, we will charge. And they charged and broke the enemy's resolve and saved the day. There were story after story after story that occurred that day, that would have been the second day of the Battle of Gettysburg. And so, you know, we have these weapons, and we have to use these weapons. Stand, therefore, having girded, verse 14, your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. And for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. This is total war. We cannot go back, and we cannot stand where we are. The enemy is stronger than we. We must attack, just as Colonel Chamberlain did on the 2nd of July, 1863, on Little Round Top at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. To retreat is to abandon all. To stand fast is to die on the spot. We have an enemy who is engaging in total warfare and who is satisfied with nothing less than our total annihilation. 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. And verse 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for pulling down strongholds. We have spiritual weapons to use. The people at Gettysburg, it's said that the weapons that they used far surpassed their tactics. As we came up through the Revolutionary War, they were accustomed to getting in rows of men, each with a musket, and standing about 100 yards apart and then just blazing away at each other. But the muskets were so inaccurate, they were called smoothbore. They didn't have rifling grooves in them. And what a rifle does is there's a groove in there that causes the bullet to spin. And because it spins, it stays on target much better. With a smoothbore, you spout it out there and it might go up or down or off to the side. They weren't very accurate. And that's the reason they got in just massed groups of men. And the idea is you throw enough lead, some of it's going to hit the target. In the Civil War, every soldier had rifles. And they were starting to have cannons that had rifles, rifled grooves. And so they would, and we saw a demonstration while we were there of a cannon being used in the reenactment that we saw. About, half mile, they shot that cannon. The first one I saw is they had an area that was about as wide as this room, and it was in a square. And there were two guys standing out there on either side of it. Now they shot this cannon and plop, right in the middle of that square, the cannonball fell. Well, they also had exploding shells. The men didn't stand here for this one. They got out of Dodge, as it were. There was one of these huge, big hay bales. And it was not just like a standard size hay bale or as one of these great big bales, bigger than a roll of hay. And I've seen them before in some of the horse farms down around Lexington, just huge big hay bale. Well, they shot again with an exploding round, and that hay bale went away. He hit it dead center from a half a mile, and it just disintegrated. The weapons were far superior. The tactics, they were still marching in close-packed rows. They had a type of shell called canister for when the enemy got close. They were about to overrun your position, they load their cannon with canister. It was a tin can filled with explosives and BBs about that size. And when it left the muzzle of the cannon, it broke apart. And so it was like a huge shotgun. And it would go through several ranks of men, killing 20 to the rank. And there are pictures by the photographers of the day showing rows of men after rows of men after rows of men just backwards on the field. Because the weapons were so good, but they were still clustering together. Okay, I'm getting way too far into this and need to go on to other things. But 1 Timothy, the first chapter and verse 18, says that we're to wage the good warfare. We must know our enemy. We must use the weapons that have been given us. And we must use the tactics that are appropriate. We must be led by our general to win this battle. Now, as I said, for many years I've been fascinated by these military issues. Not the war per se, but the heroism that goes on during war. And you ask yourself the question, why do people go to war anyway? Well, nations go to war to protect their interests. It's said that nations don't have friends, they have interests. And so when one nation gets mad at another nation, they send their armies to enforce their will on these other people. But why do individuals go to war? Well, I mean, maybe it's the draft. The nation says, you will go, or we will shoot you, or we will put you in jail, or you will be labeled a coward. Some people go for glamour. Some people go for honor. You know, the glamour, you know, they have these neat uniforms and they march up and down the street and people cheer. They go for honor, says, I'm going to be a hero. I'm going to be a hero. Nobody ever comes back from war with those same thoughts, though. They had other issues. The Confederates, they had what they call state rights. Each state has the right to decide for their state whether we should have slavery or not have slavery. And so many of the soldiers in the South felt that there was no government in Washington that had the right to tell a state what to do. It's interesting that prior to the Civil War, it was always in the plural. The United States were individual and sovereign, just like a nation was. It was the United States are. The United States are. After the Civil War was the first time anybody ever used the term the United States is as a single entity. The United States individually gave their sovereignty up. But now we conclude, after the Civil War, that it is the United States government itself that is the sovereign entity. So states' rights was a big issue. Love of country. But when Robert E. Lee was talking about love of country, he was talking about Virginia, not the United States as an entity. Some go for duty. But few who have ever been to war see many of those things as being adequate reasons. That's not why people become heroes. When you ask a soldier who has been in desperate combat, and I've seen people interview who have been in combat in the Second World War, in almost any war you can speak of, you ask them why they went forward and who performed some act of bravery, and you ask them why, it was because of relationship. I'm going to explain that a little bit. It wasn't because their government told them to do it. It wasn't because they were eager for glory or honor or any of those things. It was because of relationship. At Gettysburg, as I said, there were many examples. Little Round Top was not about when they went up that hill thinking that it's going to be certain death. They expected to survive. Now, many of them died, but they didn't go into the face of absolute death. In two occasions that I can think of, the men did. They went absolutely into the face of death. Pickett's charge on the third day, those men were told to go across the field under heavy fire. And as we looked on that field when we were there, it was an open field. There's nothing there. There's nothing to hide behind. There's nothing to block a bullet. And 15,000 men on the third day walked across that field, and the Union Army firing everything they had at them every step of the way. And half of them never survived. And they knew it when they started. Why did they do it? The other example, the charge of the first Minnesota Volunteers on the second day of the battle. Now, the first Minnesota should be one of the most famous groups of men you ever heard about. It was 262 men that comprised what was left of the 1st Minnesota Regiment. And the 1st Minnesota was the 1st Regiment, Minnesota Volunteer Infantry, was a volunteer infantry regiment that served in the Union Army during the American Civil War. It was noted in particular for its gallant service and heavy casualties at the Battle of Gettysburg. The 1st Minnesota was the first state volunteer regiment formally tendered to the service of the federal government under Abraham Lincoln's call for 75,000 troops in 1861. They were the first to respond to Abraham Lincoln's call. And what they did is, in a sense, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. Because of the huge battle that had taken place on Little Round Top and various other places, the Union Army had just pulled units away from certain places. We need more men over here. We need men over here. We're about to get overrun. So they pulled all of their units out of this one area. except for this one regiment. A fellow by the name of General Hancock rode up and he saw, there's a huge hole in our line, and here comes the Alabamans, the Confederates under General Wilcox, straight at us. He's got a whole division that he's coming across this ground, and there's nobody here except this one regiment. He rode up to a Colonel Colville, who was commanding the regiment, and he said, "See that unit? See their flag? Go bring me their flag." They were outnumbered 5-1. 272 men against 1,400 men. Colonel Colville ordered his men to fix bayonets once again. And they immediately went forward across open ground once again. They sustained 83% casualties in the next few minutes. And it saved the Union Army 5 minutes. 5 minutes. But that was enough time for General Hancock to get other men in place to plug the hole in the line. It's interesting that 5 minutes, let's see if I can find the the unit's flag. Well, I'll just read this. The men of the 1st Minnesota are most remembered for their action on July 2, 1863, during the second day's fighting at Gettysburg, where the regiment prevented the Confederates from pushing the Federals off of Cemetery Ridge, a position that was to be crucial in the battle. Major General Winifred S. Hancock, commander of the 2nd Corps, ordered the regiment to assault a much larger enemy force, a brigade commanded by Brigadier General Cadmus M. Wilcox, telling Colonel William Colville to take the enemy's colors. The fateful charge bought the time needed while other forces were brought up. During the charge, 215 members of the 262 men who were present at the time became casualties, including the regimental commander, Colonel William Colville, and all but three of his regimental captains. The unit's flag fell 5 times and rose again each time. The 47 survivors rallied back to General Hancock under the senior surviving officer, Captain Nathan S. Messick. The 83% casualty rate stands to this day as the largest loss by any surviving military unit in American history during a single engagement. And they did slow the enemy down in spite of being outnumbered 5-1. One of the participants, writing later in his life, says, "But the 1st Minnesota had never deserted any post, had never retired without orders, and that is something that is peculiar in military history. And desperate as the situation seemed, and as it was, the regiment stood firm against whatever might come. Just then, Hancock, with a single aide, rode up at full speed and for a moment vainly endeavored to rally General Sickles' retreating forces." It says reserves had been sent for, but they just needed time. And most of it I've already gone through. Every man realized in an instant what that order meant. Charge those lines. Death or wounds to us all. The sacrifice of the regiment to gain a few minutes' time and save this position. And every man saw and accepted the necessity for the sacrifice. And in a moment, responding to Coville's rapid orders, the regiment, in perfect line, with arms at right shoulder shift, was sweeping down the slope directly upon the enemy's center. No hesitation, no stopping to fire, though the men fell fast at every stride before the concentrated fire of the whole Confederate force, directed upon us as soon as the movement was observed. Silently, without orders, and almost from the start, double quick, and that's at a trot, had changed to utmost speed, and that is a dead run. For in utmost speed lay the only hope that any of us could pass through that storm of lead and to strike the enemy. "Charge!" shouted Colville as we neared the first line, and with leveled bayonets at full speed we rushed upon it. Fortunately, as it was slightly disordered in crossing a dry brook, the men were never made who will stand against leveled bayonets coming with such momentum and evident desperation. It says, the first line broke in our front as we reached it and rushed back through the second line, stopping the whole advance of the enemy. We then poured in our first fire and, availing ourselves of such shelter as the low bank of the dry brook afforded, held the entire force at bay for a considerable time and until our reserves appeared on the ridge we had left. Why the charge of the 1st Maine isn't included as a banner of heroism, I don't know. There were 2 medals of honor given that day. For the soldier that captured the enemy flag, and for the soldier who, though the flag went down 5 times, kept raising the American flag back in place. That's the kind of heroism that we must exhibit in our warfare. And when asked by veterans why, it's because they love one another. It's not for duty to country. It's, they say, we are fighting for one another. Invariably, they'll say things like, best bunch of guys I ever knew. And they lay down their lives for one another. Examples to us. And you think about it. You think about a mother or a father who walks out and sees his child walking into the street, and a car bearing down on that child. Does the parent at that point say, I can't get there in time, or I don't know if I can get there in time to save them? It's just a reflex. They go and they throw themselves to catch that child out of harm's way and out of danger. And that's what it's like. One of the prime words in the Old Testament for courage is chazak. Strong's number 3288. It's used 290 times in the Old Testament with various usages. But it means to fasten upon. It doesn't mean to be courageous. It means to fasten upon or to seize, if you look at its actual definition meaning. in Deuteronomy, the third chapter, and verse 28. Deuteronomy, the third chapter, and verse 28. But command Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people and shall cause them to inherit the land which you will see. The word there, encourage, is shakaz. And he's basically, as you see other uses of this, see that it means to seize upon. And he's talking about seizing upon God. And so you see, encourage him to seize upon God. Same idea in Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter. Same word used. Deuteronomy, the 31st chapter, verse 6. Be strong and shakaz. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, He is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Seize upon Him. Stay close to the one that can deliver you. The famous one, Joshua, the first chapter. Joshua, the first chapter. And here we have God speaking directly to Joshua. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Now, in verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and seize upon me. Shakaz. For to this people you shall divide an inheritance, as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. It's not go out and be brave. It's go out and cling to the one who can deliver you. In the New Testament, the word for encourage is parakaleo. Strong's, it's either 3820 or 3870. My handwriting sort of glitched there, so I'm not sure if it was a 2 or a 7. But 3820 or 3870, if you want to look it up, means to call near, or to invite, or to invoke, to draw in next to you. And Jesus Christ in Matthew, the 5th chapter, used this term. Matthew, the 5th chapter, and verse 4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be parakaleo. They shall be drawn near. They shall be comforted. They shall be encouraged. Matthew, the 18th chapter, and verse 29. Matthew 18 and verse 29. It's talking about the fellow who had a lot of debt, and his master forgave him. So this fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you all." What it says is parakaleo. He says, let me beseech you. Let me draw near to you. You know, let me count on your mercy. And he did. And then he went out and didn't do that for his fellow servant. 1 Corinthians, the first chapter. And it goes on and on. Our heroism is not our heroism. Our heroism is drawing close to that one that has strength for us. And it's because of relationship that we can do that. Soldiers can depend upon one another. We can depend upon God. 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, and verse 3. I'm thinking maybe I'm in the wrong place here. Maybe 2 Corinthians, but we'll move on. I'll try 2 Corinthians real fast. Yeah, it is. 2 Corinthians there. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort." Or you can also put "the God of all encouragement." "Blessed be God and Father of our," "who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For as the suffering of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. Now if we are afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effective for enduring the same suffering which we also suffer." He's basically saying, you are comforted, you are encouraged by God. Now you also need to encourage one another. Almost a couple more scriptures. Hebrews. Using these same the same word as it pops up in various places. Hebrews, the third chapter. And verse 13. "But parakaleo one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end." Encourage one another. It says exhort here, but it's to encourage. And in Hebrews, the 10th chapter, and verse 25. Hebrews 10, and verse 25. Another famous scripture. "Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting," parakaleo, "exhorting," or encouraging, "one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." And it's all because of relationship. You can't grit your teeth and become equal to the task of crossing that field in the face of the enemy fire. The reason you do it is because you're doing it for the one next to you whom you love. John 3:16. Don't even need to turn there. For God so loved you that He gave His only begotten Son. Robert E. Lee told James Longstreet, his first corps commander, says, a good soldier must love the army. But that's a trap, because a good commander must be willing to order the death of the thing that he loves. And God so loved the world that he gave, or ordered, if you please, his only begotten Son. But that's not all. Romans, the 5th chapter. God was willing to give His Son because He loved us. Romans, the 5th chapter, in verse 7. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die. Yet perhaps for a good man, someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love, His relationship of love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from wrath through Him. In verse 10, saved by His life. We have to have a relationship with one another. And we have to have a relationship with Jesus Christ and with God the Father. Because the battle that we are facing, maybe it's cheap of me to say, having never been in combat like the 1st Minnesota, or like the 20th Maine, or any of a number of men that marched across that field, or at the Battle of the Bulge in the Second World War, or in any other hotly contested area. But our warfare is just as deadly. Our warfare is for the existence of people in the kingdom of God, and ours is total warfare. So let's remember that the courage that we have has to translate to our caring for one another, for our encouraging one another, giving courage to one another, drawing close to one another. Because that's what courage really is. And drawing close to God, who has delivered men throughout history, Moses, Joshua, and so many more, and will deliver us as well.